Here we have a highly credible couple, respected in the community, who had no personal agenda for having a UFO sighting or a close encounter or an abduction. It just sort of came out of the blue when they were returning home. And there's so much evidence that this probably was a real abduction that we all have to open our eyes. It causes people to think that perhaps we really are being visited.
It was incredibly bizarre and unnerving for Betty and Barney. He wanted to break away and flee back to the car. He had a great deal of difficulty doing this. For some reason, he just couldn't pull those binoculars down from his eyes, and he felt like he was being somehow controlled. But he finally was able to pull them down and run back to the car in a near hysterical state, screaming to Betty that they had to get out of there or they were going to be captured.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Banal of America Audio, with your host, Tim Banal.
What is going on, my friends? This is Tim Banal of banalofamerica.com with another edition of BOA Audio Season 6. Before we dive into this installment of the program, allow me to tip my cap and thank our buddy Ian for providing the theme music to this edition of BOA Audio. Now let's get down to business on this installment of the program, and we are coming at you faster than normal here, and that is because this is our last push for the upcoming Exeter UFO Festival, and the Exeter UFO Festival is coming up here September 3rd in Exeter, New Hampshire. As you may have heard by now, I am the MC for the big event, and I am also a huge fan of the festival, which is why I am pushing it super hard this year. Check out ExeterUFOFestival.com for more information about the big event, and allow me to stress one more time that the entire conference is absolutely free, and we've got some amazing speakers there, including Rich Dolan and Stanton Friedman, as well as, and now we segue into this week's BOA Audio, our guest here tonight, Kathleen Marden. And in a way, it's kind of perfect that we've got Kathleen Marden here on the show right before the Exeter UFO Festival this year, because it is the 50th anniversary of the iconic Betty and Barney Hill abduction case, and much of the festivities surrounding this year's Exeter event are devoted to remembering, celebrating, and investigating the Betty and Barney Hill case. So it all comes around here full circle on BOA Audio. For the folks who can't make the trip out to Exeter, you're going to get a taste of what we're going to hear at the big event. And for the folks who can make it out there, here's a little bit of a teaser and an opportunity to hear from someone that you're going to get the chance to meet at Exeter. Talking about, of course, Kathleen Marden. As many of you may know, Kathleen Marden is the niece of Betty and Barney Hill. That's something I've known for quite some time, but what I did not pick up until I read the book Captured, which she co-authored with Stanton Friedman, is that not only is Kathleen Marden Betty and Barney Hill's niece, but she heard about Betty and Barney Hill's encounter with the UFO literally the very day they returned to their home following the incident. She probably is maybe the second person on Earth ever to hear the Betty and Barney Hill story. So her perspective on this case is absolutely unparalleled. And that is why I was thrilled to get her on BOA Audio here for an in-depth discussion on this iconic case. And knowing that Kathleen was there for every step of the way, and then later in life spent decades investigating the Betty and Barney Hill case, I knew at certain points when just to get out of her way and allow her to really discuss this thing in breathtaking detail, which she does over the course of the entire conversation, because we are going to go over this case from the very beginning and cover all of the major events along the way in the Betty and Barney Hill abduction case. We'll start, of course, with the initial incident, what happened that night, September 19th, 1961 in New Hampshire. Kathy is going to paint a picture that will definitely have you in chills. From there, we're going to talk about the subsequent years of investigation into the case by NICAP and ufologists, the historic and terrifying hypnosis sessions with Dr. Simon, the traumatic outing of Betty and Barney Hill's abduction case at the hands of an unscrupulous reporter, the overnight celebrity that was bestowed upon the couple once they embraced their tale, and Barney's tragic demise, which led to even more bizarre incidents for Betty Hill in the years that followed. Plus, of course, tons and tons more. Now, I am certain that there are many, many folks out there who have heard the story of Betty and Barney Hill, and I have a feeling there are some folks out there who are kind of rolling their eyes and saying, why revisit this case? But trust me, folks, this is a BOA audio interview for the books, because it is truly a comprehensive discussion with Kathleen Martin, a researcher who was afforded an amazing first-hand perspective on one of ufology's most historic events of all time, talking about the Betty and Barney Hill abduction case. Before I give you the bio here on Kathleen Martin, I want to mention one more interesting little tidbit that you are definitely going to notice as the interview unfolds. We ran into some very strange technical difficulties during the course of the recording of this conversation. What makes that strange is that these issues only came up when we were trying to tackle two very specific questions related to the Betty and Barney Hill incident. Normally, I would take this sort of stuff out of the program. I try to take out any sort of issues that come up as we're taping the show. But this time around, something stood out to me. Something just didn't seem quite right about these technical difficulties that we were having. It just didn't sit well with me. And it became a point of conversation later in the interview with Kathleen Martin. So I felt like I had to do justice to the weirdness that was these issues by keeping them in the program. I definitely cleaned them up a little bit, took out a lot of stuff to make it at least a little more palatable to the listeners, but you'll know for sure when these strange happenings occurred, and I'm going to leave it up to you to make your own judgment on what that was all about, but I will share a little bit more insight into my thoughts on it at the end of the program. But keep an ear out for that as the interview unfolds. For those of you who are unfamiliar with Kathleen Martin, allow me to provide you with a little background on her. Scientific ufologist Kathleen Martin earned her BA in social work at the University of New Hampshire in 1971. Thereafter, she entered into graduate studies in education at the University of Cincinnati and later at UNH. She began her professional career as a social worker and eventually entered the field of education as a teacher. Later, she was promoted to a supervisory position, coordinating education programs and supervising education staff. She left her job in 1990 to pursue a career as a UFO investigator, researcher, and writer. She taught adult education classes on UFO and abduction history, and for 10 years volunteered as the Mutual UFO Network's Director of Field Investigator Training. In 2003, MUFON publicly recognized Kathy for her most outstanding contribution of advancing the scientific study of the UFO phenomenon by dedicating the annual MUFON International UFO Proceedings to her. Her 2007 book, Captured: The Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience, with co-author Stanton T. Friedman, is a case study of her aunt and uncle's 1961 UFO close encounter and abduction. In 2010, Kathy co-authored Science Was Wrong with Stan Friedman, and 2011 brought a new book, UFOs and Aliens, with a chapter on alien abduction by Kathy. Her new DVD, In Their Own Words, was released in June 2011. Kathy has appeared on dozens of television and radio programs in the United States, Canada, and Europe, including the History Channel, the Discovery Channel, New Hampshire's Chronicle, Fox News, and Coast to Coast AM. Additionally, she has lectured at major conferences and colleges throughout the United States. Her website is www.kathleen-marden.com. Check it out. And with all that said, let's get down to business and rock and roll. This interview was recorded on August 24th, 2011. Kathleen Martin talking about the Betty and Barney Hill abduction incident on BOA Audio Season 6. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of BOA Audio Season 6.
very excited about this installment of the program. We're going to be examining really one of the most iconic UFO cases in the history of ufology, and it's coming up on its 50th anniversary, and I'm talking about the Betty and Barney Hill abduction. I mean, when you say iconic, that's almost an understatement. I mean, this thing has tremendous historical implications for the world of the paranormal across the board. And we've got as our guest Kathleen Martin. She is the niece of Betty and Barney Hill. And what you'll find out as we go along here, which is fascinating to me, which I learned from reading her book that she co-authored with Stan Friedman called Captured, is that she's not just like their niece that she heard the story like secondhand years and years later. She was really right there on the front lines as this thing was unfolding and was there for a lot of seminal moments in the Betty and Barney Hill case, which I find just tremendously fascinating. So we're going to get into all that here tonight with Kathleen Martin. It's really a thrill to have her on the show. Kathleen, welcome to BOA Audio.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
We usually start out here kind of with the bio, the background. I sort of, spoiled it a little bit for folks, but, you know, chances are they've heard by now your connection to Betty and Barney Hill. But, you know, you've dedicated so much of your life getting their story out. I don't want to lose who Kathleen Martin is. So, you know, give us your bio, your background. You know, what's your story all about beyond just the Betty and Barney Hill case?
Well, I was 13 years old when Betty called my mother to tell her about the close encounter that she and my uncle had the night before on September 19th and into the early morning hours of September 20th, 1961. I was seated in the same room. And this sparked my curiosity, and it was something I was so interested in as I was growing up through my teenage years, as Betty and Barney were beginning to be permitted by Dr. Simon to recall the details of their separate hypnosis sessions with him. But after high school, I pursued my own career. And I went to college, I became a social worker, and then I went to graduate school in education. I taught school for a number of years. I was an education services coordinator, and also wrote a great deal about the projects that I worked on in the field of education. But around the year 1985 to 1990, perhaps, I started to read articles in mainstream magazines, articles that were written by people like Carl Sagan and Philip Klass, two skeptics, that seemed to be misrepresenting the facts in the Hill case. And at that point, I can tell you that I really wasn't certain of what the actual accurate information was. Mm-hmm. And I started to ask my aunt about this. And she then opened up her files to me. And it so happened that I was in a position where I was able to stop working with the help of my husband, who was supporting my work and my pursuit to investigate my aunt and uncle's UFO experience and to do the long research project that I would have to undertake in order to find out all of the details about what happened to them. So I then started working very closely with my Aunt Betty. I would travel the 20 miles or so to her house in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, from my home in East Kingston on the seacoast. And I started doing interviews with her. And I played devil's advocate through all of these interviews, attempting to poke holes in her story, attempting to debunk her story myself. She also turned over those files to me. These were 40 years in the end of letters to and from scientists, all of the original early investigation reports, the reports from other investigators who had contacted her over the years. So I ended up with a wealth of information about her case. And she and I would make yearly trips up to the Close Encounter route. We would drive along the Close Encounter route. We would stop at the stops that she and my uncle stopped at on the night of their close encounter. We would talk about, and in fact, I even tape recorded her statements about each stop along the way. We would go to the abduction site, and we would visit the abduction site and walk on that. I attempted to lose time there. I attempted to find a prosaic explanation for that two-hour period of lost time that my aunt and uncle had, and found out that I just simply could not do it.
Yeah.
Driving those back roads, I was able to eventually lose maybe a half hour or 45 minutes, but nowhere near the full 2 hours that they lost, even accounting for the time that they stopped, because I would time those stops. I also was very interested in the hypnosis tapes.
Yeah.
And in 1996, she obtained a release of information and turned those hypnosis tapes over to me for comparative analysis. I transcribed the tapes, and then I lined her sentences up against Barney's, statement by statement, and compared their statements against, under hypnosis, against the statements in the original reports, and against her statements in a 5-page paper that she had written about a series of dreams that she had a couple of weeks after her close encounter in 1961. In those dreams, and they occurred in the early morning hours, just before she woke up, in those dreams were pieces of the information that she had conscious recall for regarding the close encounter, before the close encounter and after it. But sandwiched in between was an abduction by aliens. Actually, the aliens in her abduction, in her dreams, looked very much like Southern Europeans. They looked very human, not like the ones that she and my uncle remembered under hypnosis. But there was also an abduction sequence where she and my uncle were taken on board a craft, where she was given a physical examination, where she had an interview, and then she was released. And so I wanted to examine her statements made under hypnosis and my uncle's statements versus the information in that dream sequence to find out if, in fact, she merely had repeated this fantasy material under hypnosis, and if my uncle had somehow gleaned that information and confabulated his own abduction experience under hypnosis.
Right, right. So that's what the skeptics are always saying, yeah.
I took a very scientific approach to this. I was very interested in the study of hypnosis. I had studied it. I wrote a couple of papers on it, research papers, and eventually I ended up becoming a credentialed hypnotherapist. My background is in the social sciences. I was, as I said, a social worker, and then I went into the field of education, but my primary interest was always in the social sciences.
Interesting, interesting. Okay, well, it sounds like you've had this amazingly fantastic research opportunity at the risk of, you know, sort of stripping it down to almost a scientific level. I mean, just stunning, not only the information, but the ability to go firsthand right to Betty and discuss this is, you know, a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for any researcher. So, you know, tremendous stuff. Just to sort of bring the audience up to speed, you know, let's sort of give them the thumbnail what is the Betty and Barney Hill story? I know you've probably told it a million times, and I apologize for having to ask you this, but, you know, I feel like the show is sort of like the, you know, the historical record, at least we strive to be. So, you know, tell the story of what happened to Betty and Barney Hill way back then in 1961.
Yes, it's always important for the listeners to know what happened.
Exactly. Then we're all on the same page. Yep.
Yes. Betty and Barney were on a short vacation to upstate New York and Canada, to Montreal, and they were driving home to the New Hampshire home on New Hampshire's seacoast, Portsmouth, New Hampshire, at night. When they were in Montreal, they heard that a hurricane was coming up the coast. And so they decided that instead of spending the night at Montreal, they should drive home. Now, this wasn't a problem for Barney, who was well rested from the night before, and he worked for the Boston Post Office on the graveyard shift, so he was accustomed to staying up all night. And he and my aunt decided that if they grew tired, they'd stop in New Hampshire at a cabin on the way home. So they're driving through upstate New Hampshire when my aunt spots a new light in the sky. The thing that drew her attention to it is that at first she wondered if it was a falling star, but it fell upward. And then it stopped beside the moon. And this was very perplexing to her. She wondered if it was a satellite. My grandfather was very, very interested in satellites. In fact, I grew up across the street from him. And we would go out at night and look for satellites and observe satellites in the sky. But Betty had never done this. So she wondered if that's what it might be, and she continued to watch it. Well, it stopped beside the moon and started to grow larger and larger in size. And when she and my uncle reached the town of Twin Mountain, it was large enough so that it really piqued her curiosity. It was then about a quarter the size of the moon, which was a waxing gibbous moon that night. The sky was bright and starry. The visibility from the top of Mount Washington was 130 miles.
Oh, wow.
So she told my uncle she wanted to stop. She wanted to get a better look at this through the binoculars. So he did pull over to the side of the road at the Mount Cleveland picnic area. This was their first stop. And they got out of the car. She took the binoculars, and she looked at it as it traveled across the moon flashing multicolored lights. My uncle then took the binoculars, and he looked at it. It was traveling west toward Vermont, and then without looking as if it had turned, it descended very rapidly in his direction. And it was silent, and it was large enough now so that he could see a row of windows that gave it a cigar-shaped appearance. He got back into the car and started driving south as Betty continued to watch this craft. They entered the north end of Franconia Notch, and Franconia Notch is a very popular tourist area. It's a beautiful area. As you enter it, you come to the Cannon Mountain Aerial Tramway. It's a small ski area, and it's open in the summer, too. You can ride the tramway to the top of the mountain. There's a restaurant up there, and there's also a signal tower that is lighted at night. It has a steady burning light. And Betty noticed that as the craft passed over the top of Cannon Mountain, a light blinked out. And she was perplexed by this. She didn't know anything about UFO. She'd never read a book on the subject. And my uncle was a confirmed skeptic at that point. He didn't believe that UFOs were real. And so she didn't know that it might have been electromagnetic interference from the craft that caused the light to blink out. Well, they continued to watch as they're driving down the road, and they stopped, they decided to stop by the Old Man of the Mountain, which is about a mile south of the Cannon Mountain aerial tramway. So they pulled beside the road there. It looked different then than it does today if you ever go up there. Interstate Highway 93 is in the location where U.S. Route 3 used to be in that area. So it's now four lanes, and it has been built up and elevated above the level that it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
But Betty and Barney stopped by the Old Man of the Mountain and got out again. They took the binoculars, and they looked at this craft. At that time, it hovered beside the old man's profile. And what is significant here is the old man's profile was 48 feet from forehead to chin.
Mm-hmm.
He fell off the mountain in 2003, but he was there in 1961.
Yeah.
And craft was 1.5 times, at least 1.5 times, the length of the old man's profile.
Hmm.
He was about 3,000 feet above sea level. So he was probably about 1,500 feet above where Betty and Barney were standing. That estimate may not be correct on my part. It could be a couple of thousand feet. But anyway, they stood, they looked at it through binoculars. The craft at that point appeared to have begun rotating. They could see this blip, blip, blip as it rotated. And then it started to move. It started to bounce back and forth in the sky and also to travel in what appeared to be like a stair-step pattern. They returned to the car. Barney was anxious to get home.
Yeah.
And they drove through Franconia Notch. They exited the south entrance by an area called Indian Head. And Betty was becoming excited at this point. And Barney was a little bit irritated with her because he said that Betty rarely became excited. So this had to be something pretty significant, but he had to drive. He couldn't look up at this thing and watch the road at the same time. So he was looking for a place to pull over, but before he even had the opportunity to do that, this craft shifted ahead and stopped right over the highway and just to the right of the highway. That would be the west of the highway, causing Barney to have to stop the car directly in the middle of the road in order not to be directly underneath it. And then it descended in their direction and stopped an estimated 100 to 200 feet above their car. In their first report, the first picture they drew, Barney drew a picture of the craft, and he said that it was about, that's how it looked when it was about 200 feet above the car. They could tell at that point that it was not cigar-shaped. What gave it the cigar-shaped appearance was the lighted windows. They could now see that it was dish-shaped, and he described it as looking like a giant pancake. It had still that lighted row of windows, and there was an intense blue-white light that was shining from behind those windows. He stepped out of the car. He had his gun, and he had his binoculars. He had taken the gun out of the trunk of the car way back when they were at their first stop because there was a picnic area there with trash barrels, and he was afraid that bears might be coming out of the woods.
Mm-hmm.
It was an area where there were bears. So at this point, he took the gun not because he was afraid of bears, but because he was feeling a little bit weary of the situation that he was in. He was a little afraid of this craft.
Yeah.
So he's looking at it through binoculars. Betty's looking at it through the passenger from the passenger seat through the windshield, and the craft then shifts position again. And then he described it almost, it glided in an arc-like pattern over to an adjacent field, which was just to his east. This was a farmer's field. There were some apple trees there. There was a farm stand where they sold probably apples in the fall, maybe vegetables in the summer. But a typical New Hampshire farm stand. And he walked into the field and looked through binoculars up at the craft. Now, what he saw were figures. And this is part of his conscious recall. I'm still working on conscious recall here.
Okay, yep.
He said there were 8 to 11 figures staring down at him. And he also, his initial reports, the first one was September 26, 1961, stated that they were dressed in shiny black uniforms. And in October 21st, 1961, he told Walter Webb that they were somehow not human. He wasn't sure exactly what their features looked like, but he knew that they were not human beings on board that craft. They, all but one, suddenly turned and walked toward what appeared to be a panel on the back of this corridor that seemed to circle around this craft. He could at least see it on the front portion of the craft.
Yeah.
And when they went there, he could see their arms going up into the air. And when their arms went up, lights that seemed to be on each side of the craft, these little red lights, seemed to come out on little fin-like structures, and something started to drop down out of the bottom of the craft. Barney said at that point, looking through the binoculars, they appeared to be about the length of a pencil from the distance that he was viewing them. And I'm talking about the figures on board the craft.
Okay.
He could see them from the tops of their heads down to their lower legs. And the leader, he called him the leader, who was standing in the window staring down at him, held a special attraction for Barney. And Barney was terribly frightened by this leader who was staring down at him. He thought that the leader had a plan for him, and that that plan was to capture him and quote, like a bug in a net, closed quote. He wanted to break away and flee back to the car. He had a great deal of difficulty doing this. For some reason, he just couldn't pull those binoculars down from his eyes, and he felt like he was being somehow controlled. But he finally was able to pull them down and run back to the car in a near hysterical state, screaming to Betty that they had to get out of there or they were going to be captured. He went speeding down U.S. Route 3, and he told Betty to look up to see if she could see the craft, because when he ran to the car, he could see the craft shifting back from the field over the top of the car. She rolled down the window, she looked up, and all she could see was blackness. She couldn't see the stars, she couldn't see the moon, she couldn't see the lights on the craft. It was sort of like a black void. And then she and Barney heard a series of code-like beeping or buzzing sounds that seemed to be striking the trunk of the car. And it caused the car to vibrate and for a tingling sensation to pass through their bodies. The next thing they knew, as if only a moment had passed, they were 30 to 35 miles south on Route 3. They had very little recall of what happened in that 35 miles. They heard a second series of beeping or buzzing sounds, and that is what jogged them back into full consciousness. And they had vague memories of observing a fiery orb in the road silhouetted against some trees, and vague memories of encountering a roadblock, but they didn't know where or when that occurred. They then continued on driving south to their home in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. They looked up from time to time. They didn't see the craft again. But when they arrived home, they realized that they were a little later than they had anticipated. It was now dawn, and they expected to be home at about 3 o'clock in the morning. They didn't realize for a couple of months, when they had the opportunity to actually reconstruct all of their stops and their trip, that it was a full 2 hours that they were missing. But they did observe physical evidence that something had happened that they could not explain. Betty's dress was torn in several spots. The top of her zipper had a 2-inch tear. It was torn from waist to hemline on the lining, and the hem was torn down on one side. It was in fine shape when she put it on that morning. There was no prosaic explanation for how that had occurred. Barney was a meticulous dresser. The tops of his shoes were scraped, and they were so badly scraped that he had to buy new shoes and use those for yard work after that. The watches they had been wearing that night, they were typical wind-up watches, from that period of time. They worked fine, but Betty's was still working at 11:10 when she passed Cannon Mountain and looked at it. But they had stopped working and they never ran again. There were also shiny circles on the trunk of their vehicle. They were all about the size of half dollars, the silver dollars, and they caused a compass needle to spin and spin when a compass was placed over them. But the needle would drop down when it was moved to another area of the car. They felt contaminated. They were perplexed. They were shocked. They were worried that they might have been exposed to something that might harm them.
Wow.
And they were immediately perplexed by all of this. Barney wanted to forget the whole thing. But Betty wanted to learn as much as she possibly could about it.
Very just fascinating. I love the way you tell the story too, such detail. I wish you could see me listening to this, because as you're sort of like telling, how Barney's looking up and he's looking, I'm sort of like, trying to mimic these things and get into that experience. So just fascinating. Now, at what point, to sort of bring this back to the personal end now, how did you find out about all this? You know, they come home, they think something happened, something obviously very strange happened. You know, at what point did you hear this whole story?
It was the same day that they arrived home.
Oh, wow.
When they went home, they took long showers and they went to bed. They slept a few hours and then they woke up and they actually went into different rooms and sketched what they had observed. And then Betty called my mother and told my mother about what their close encounter, about this craft they had observed. I was in the same room, so I heard about it that day. Within a couple of days, my family drove from our house in Kingston, New Hampshire, to Betty's and Barney's house. And I actually got to observe those shiny spots on the trunk of the car. I heard the story again from Betty, and Barney sat in the living room talking to my father. And I asked my father recently about Barney's statements, and he said that Barney was very clear about what he saw and the fact that he did observe non-humans on board that craft.
Yeah, that's remarkable that that's part of his conscious memory, because, you know, a lot of people dog on hypnosis and everything, but, I mean, we're talking about something that has absolutely no connection in any way to the hypnosis part of the whole case.
That's absolutely true, and I think that that part of the story has been underplayed over the years. People would like to think that they just saw a distant light in the sky and then Betty had some dreams and that's where all the story came from. But that's absolutely false. And when I speak, when I do my lecture in Exeter at the UFO Festival, I'm going to be presenting the evidence, the original documented evidence that shows what Betty and Barney actually did recall.
That's great, yeah, because like you said, that's underreported. It's underemphasized, which is key. It's a key part of the story that this is the first time I've learned this information. What was your mother's reaction? What was the family reaction to this? Because this is a different time. This is sort of like, this is the early 60s. I mean, nowadays, people have their own, you know, preconceptions and ideas about UFOs. Back then, it was a completely different world. You know, what was the reaction as you guys heard this story?
Well, we were fascinated. We were perplexed. And we were concerned for Betty and Barney. Because if this indeed had come from outer space, then perhaps Betty and Barney had been exposed to contaminants. Perhaps Betty and Barney would suffer the health effects of this experience. So we were very concerned for their well-being.
Did they seem okay, though, relatively? I mean, they didn't seem, even though you said they felt contaminated, they didn't seem sick or anything like that when you guys saw them like a couple weeks later.
No, it was a couple of days later.
Oh, a couple of days, I'm sorry, yeah.
And no, they did not seem ill.
Now, I want to make sure I ask you about this, because it was in my notes here from Captured, and it just blew my mind, and I presume that, you know, you would have more information on this. At one point, shortly after the abduction, Betty and Barney are out somewhere, and they come home, and there's a pile of dried leaves on the center of the table, and then underneath those are the earrings that Betty was wearing the night of the encounter, which she had never even realized had gone missing. So, I mean, tell a little bit about that story and you know, what do you think is going on there? That's just tremendously bizarre beyond even the whole abduction scenario.
Absolutely. It was incredibly bizarre and unnerving for Betty and Barney. They had actually gone up to the White Mountains that day. They were attempting to jog their memories to remember the details of what happened during that period of lost time. And they returned home, and on their dining room table, they saw leaves that hadn't been there in the morning. They were withered brown leaves. They went over and picked the leaves up to throw them into the trash, and there were the earrings that Betty had been wearing on the night of her experience. She didn't know that they were missing. She never knew whether or not they were missing or who put those leaves there with those earrings. But I recall that she and my uncle then came to my childhood home. They were very distressed. They talked to my parents and decided that they should put new deadbolt locks on the doors. And I remember how my father went down and assisted Barney in putting those locks on.
And how soon after the experience was this, the dry leaf incident?
Well, they started to go back and to their site to along the close encounter route. I think it was in about December of 1961. So I would say this was probably the winter or early spring of 1961 that this occurred.
Okay, so about, you know, four.
I don't recall exactly what the date was.
Yeah. But at that point, how many people had even heard the whole story of what happened to them? Probably only a very, very, very small handful of people, right?
Very small handful. The Air Force officers who interviewed them for the Project Blue Book report, Walter Webb from NICAP, Donald Kehoe from NICAP, Robert Homan and C.D. Jackson, who were two of the early investigators in that case, too, and their friend who was had recently retired from Pease Air Force Base, James McDonald, Jim McDonald, not to be confused with the physicist from Arizona, mm-hmm. this was an Air Force officer. He was also undercover for the CIA. So, you know, it's hard to say if this was activity from an intelligence agency designed to unnerve Betty and Barney, or if this was ET activity. Who knows? But it certainly was unnerving.
Yeah. That's the strange part. As I said, like I asked you here, so, sort of for a proverbial list of suspects, and it's like even if it was put there by a human, that has all kinds of implications, because it stands to reason that the only way the earrings would have gone missing was during the abduction experience at some point, which would necessitate some kind of human ET connection to get the earrings back. So it's bizarre. The whole thing is very strange.
It is bizarre, because who would have known what earrings Betty was wearing that night?
Exactly.
Only she knew, probably. But there they were on the table.
Very, very weird stuff. So, okay, so I'm trying to, like, stay within the chronology here of this whole story, too. So they come home, and, you know, Barney doesn't really want to pursue this. Betty does. What's their next step? Report this to the Air Force and the authorities?
Yes. When she called my mother, the former chief of police of Newton, New Hampshire, happened to be visiting. He was my father's best friend. He stopped by for coffee on his way home from work every night. And he had been informed by Pease Air Force Base that if anyone reported a UFO, that the police should advise them to call Pease. Mm-hmm. So my mother then told Betty to make a formal report. And Betty and Barney were law-abiding citizens, and they wanted to do the right thing, so they called Pease Air Force Base, and they made a report.
Right. Like I said, different era. Nowadays, people would probably be very suspicious or not want their names out there. I'm sure that they – was there an underlying concern about the ridicule associated with this subject, especially back then? You know, were they like, listen, we don't want this story to get out?
Well, certainly Barney didn't want it to get out, and I guess Betty didn't either, because it was supposed to remain confidential. It was only released to the public in 1965 through a violation of confidentiality. So, yes, I imagine there was a ridicule factor back then as well.
Yeah. So, you know, it stands to reason here that obviously, the report to the Air Force didn't really see any answers, because we're still talking about this case now. So I presume the Air Force gave them the runaround, and then what was the next step for them to contact the UFO intelligentsia, if you will, you know, the folks like NICAP?
Yes. Well, the Air Force did take a report. The officer was very interested, Betty said. He also seemed skeptical, but he was very interested in some of the details of the craft, and he did state that he didn't know if it was related or not, but they had picked something up on radar that same night at 2:14 a.m. at Pease Air Force Base. So I do have the Air Force Blue Book report, and it is in the appendix of Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience, by Stanton Friedman and myself. Then Betty was very curious, naturally. She's a very curious person. So she went to the library and took out a book about UFOs. It was the first book she'd ever read on the topic. It was written by Donald Kehoe, and in the back of the book was a statement that if anyone observed a UFO, they should report it to NICAP. So she sat down on September 26, 1961, and wrote a one-page letter to Donald Kehoe. And there were some very interesting things in that letter. I'll be showing that also when I speak in Exeter.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that she stated was that they had had a close encounter with this craft, that it had moved in a stair-step pattern, that it was silent, that it was hovering, that my Uncle Barney seemed to have developed a mental block after he had observed individuals dressed in black, shiny uniforms, and that they were considering the possibility of looking for a psychiatrist who used hypnosis to help to recover the memories that Barney had lost, that he couldn't remember about the appearance of these beings. So that's a little known fact, but they were thinking about that only 6 days after it happened.
Amazing. Amazing. This is why I'm so thrilled to have you on the show, because there's so much information here that is just so fresh to so many people, because you have such firsthand experience on this. Okay, so then they're thinking about the hypnosis. They've contacted NICAP. As you said, it sounds like NICAP really – I'm surprised, actually, that NICAP got involved in this in a way, because it seems like back then there was quite the anti-being bias, if you will, with it. A lot of these UFO researchers didn't even want to touch cases that involved beings of any kind.
There certainly was. I mean, there had never been an abduction report to NICAP before, and NICAP didn't even want to consider the idea that these UFOs might be manned by intelligent beings. I guess they preferred to think they were remote controlled. But anyway, Walter Webb, who was an astronomer, he was a lecturer at Hayden Planetarium at the Museum of Science in Boston, was assigned to the case. And he went up on October 21st and interviewed Betty and Barney separately and then together for the six-hour period. And then he went home. He wrote a report dated October 26th. It was a lengthy, detailed report about what Betty and Barney had actually observed. So this was a very significant piece of my information in writing Captured. I've been in touch with Walter. I met him back when I was a teenager. I admired him. In fact, he helped my father to find a telescope for me. I became very, very interested in astronomy after my aunt and uncle had this experience and needed a telescope at that point. But getting back to Walter, I have to say that I admire his investigation of my aunt and uncle and of another UFO abduction he investigated. It was a 1968 abduction he investigated in 1978. He is a very, very thorough investigator and very objective and unbiased, and he did a terrific job on this. And he wrote many, many letters to my Aunt Betty, and they were very valuable to me when I was doing my research on Captured, because Betty would write to him and she would tell him how she and my uncle were feeling and how what they had discovered on each one of these trips that they took up into the White Mountains and what memories were jogged during that trip. So I could see how memories would come back to them a little bit more and a little bit more over time before they actually underwent hypnosis with Dr. Simon. Very interesting.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. Now, keeping sort of in the theme here of this chronology of the story, so the NICAP's looking at this. At some point, you reach a dead end, in a sense, because we just really don't know what's going on with the UFO phenomenon. So then they want to take this to the next level, so they do go to Dr. Simon. Approximately what time frame did all this start then?
Okay, it was not NICAP who went to Dr. Simon.
Yeah,
it was Betty and Barney.
That's what I meant by that, yeah.
Barney had begun to suffer from symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. He had developed bleeding ulcers. He hadn't been a drinker, but he was experiencing a lot of anxiety, and he was self-medicating with alcohol. And this was a real problem. So he started to see a psychiatrist locally. But the psychiatrist didn't understand what Barney's problem was. He had made a very nice adjustment to his new life in New Hampshire after he had married Betty. He seemed very happy. He really didn't have a significant problem. But Barney then mentioned to him one day when he was in a session with him that he and my aunt had spent the previous weekend at the White Mountains attempting to jog their memories about this lost time. And so the psychiatrist then decided that perhaps that could explain Barney's physiological symptoms. And he made a referral to Dr. Benjamin Simon. The referral was made in the fall of 1963, and they saw Dr. Simon for the first time in December of 63 for consultation. And their first hypnosis sessions were in January of 1963, and this was a period of conditioning. But Barney's first taped hypnosis session, the regression, was on February 22nd, 1964. Now, Dr. Simon was very, very skilled in what he did. He was a psychiatrist trained in the use of deep trance hypnosis to resolve traumatic amnesia. He had had a tremendous amount of success working with shell shock victims after and during World War II. He had set up the psychiatric unit at the Mason General Hospital on Long Island in New York, and he was the chief of neuropsychiatry. He treated victims of what was then called conversion hysteria, and what that means is these people would return from the war, let's say, a man was unable to walk, but there was no physical reason. It was a psychological reason. And Dr. Simon would place him into deep trance hypnosis, and under hypnosis, he would recall what had happened to him that caused him to develop this trauma. And where other psychiatrists hadn't been successful, Dr. Simon was successful because he was tenacious. He didn't take the first explanation. In one case that I am thinking of right now that was in the movie Let There Be Light, made about Dr. Simon's work, there was a man who was blind for psychological reasons. Now, he had been in a foxhole, and he had seen his buddy's head blown off. But he had not, his symptoms had not receded through treatment with other psychiatrists. And Dr. Simon pushed him to find out what other reasons there were to cause this. And he found out that this man had received a Dear John letter from his sweetheart before this had happened to him. So it was a combination of those two disappointing and shocking events that caused this man's symptoms. And then you could see that this man suddenly had his eyesight back, just as you could see in the earlier case I talked about with a man went in a wheelchair, he walked out of that room.
Wow.
And Dr. Simon had a tremendous amount of success in treating these men. He won awards from the Army for his work. He won the Commendation Medal. He was in Who's Who in America. He taught at Harvard. He lectured at Yale. He was really outstanding in his field, and he did not believe that UFOs were real.
And then he ends up with this case. And
then he ends up with this very perplexing case. Yes.
was he reluctant to take it on, or was he more of like, this is a challenge, this is a, you know, a tremendous challenge that I'm interested in pursuing?
He didn't seem reluctant to take it on. He immediately assumed that there had to be a psychological explanation for this, and there had to be a mundane explanation for this, that it couldn't have been related to a UFO sighting.
Interesting. So this is So we're talking about 3 years and change after the initial abduction that the hypnosis starts.
Well, it happened in 61. In September of 61, it was January of 64.
Oh, so 2 years and change. There you go, yeah.
Yes, years and change. Yes. And so he took Barney first and hypnotized him, did a couple of hypnosis sessions with him. The interesting thing about Barney is that he didn't do what we normally think of as hypnotherapy today with abductees. He did hypnoanalysis with Barney. He was a psychoanalyst. So it was sort of like psychoanalysis, but in hypnoanalysis, you can just break down a person's defense mechanisms and just lay their psyche bare and really get to their deepest level. And so that's what he did with Barney. And Barney was actually his patient, but Betty was only there as someone that he could hypnotize who went through the same experience so he could compare notes, sort of, in the beginning anyway. He did realize after a while that that Betty had experienced trauma as well.
Yeah. And then, okay, so we're talking 2.5 years or so, 2 years and change after the event, and then they're going to hypnosis. How long did these, not the specific actual session, but how long did the hypnosis, you know, treatment last? How long was that ongoing?
Well, the treatment was for 6 months,
okay.
And he took Betty and Barney separately. One waited in a soundproof office while with classical music playing on the hypnosis tape. You can hear that music, sometimes very loud. One was in his office and for the hypnosis session, and then Dr. Simon reinstated amnesia at the end of each session so that they couldn't remember what they had recalled under hypnosis.
Oh,
and therefore wouldn't experience the trauma of remembering these very traumatic events all at once, and also it guaranteed they wouldn't contaminate the information.
Absolutely, yeah, that's what I was going to say. Very interesting and very thoughtful technique. See, this is why I'm not a hypnotist. I wouldn't have thought of that. And then I would have been like, oh, no, they're going to go home and talk about this. So that went on for about 6 months. So then we're getting into almost like about the third anniversary here. So you must have been, as a kid, you're following this. Did you, right from the start, think that this was like a UFO that they saw, or you just weren't sure? And did your, like, perspective on all this change as their perspectives changed?
No, I was a pretty naive child. And, you know, I didn't know that UFOs even existed, but it was sort of an awakening for me, and I believed that it did happen.
I guess we'll skip sort of ahead a little bit in the chronology here to when they were outed as abductees in this newspaper article. How did all that go down? Because it sounded like it was devastating in a lot of ways to them to have to overnight deal with this. I mean, it's one thing to sort of slowly, you know, creep it out into the public eye, but they were just sort of like just completely outed with obviously without their permission or intent. So I guess talk a little bit about that what happened there.
Absolutely. It was devastating because Betty was a social worker for the state of New Hampshire. Barney worked for the post office. He had been appointed to serve on the U.S. Civil Rights Commission's State Advisory Committee for the state of New Hampshire. He had campaigned for Lyndon Johnson. He and Betty and I were invited guests to Johnson's inauguration. He was the chairman of the board of directors for the Rockingham County Community Action Program, a program my aunt and uncle had helped to set up. They were well known throughout the state. They worked on a literacy program. They were active in the NAACP. So they were known and respected in their community and throughout the state, and all of a sudden, this article appeared in the Boston Traveler, and they were horrified. It ran for 5 nights. They thought they were going to lose their jobs, their standing in the community. It was the worst thing that could possibly have happened to them,
at that time, and they fled from their home in Portsmouth. The media was around. They were getting phone calls, and they went down to my grandparents' house. And I lived directly across the street from my grandparents. And so we all congregated in my grandparents' living room and discussed this and what to do next. You know, it was really perplexing at that point. When you're outed, what do you do?
And what was exactly what was that conversation like? What were the options considered? I guess you could say what were you saying you should do next?
Well, they couldn't deny it. That would be lying. And as we discussed it, we thought, well, maybe they should just come clean and go forward with the story of what did happen to them, to talk about the differences between what did happen and the story in the Boston newspaper, because that story wasn't accurate. It was based upon hearsay. Some people believe that this reporter had actually gotten a hold of the abduction tape. I say that that would have been impossible because the information was inaccurate. It had to have been passed to him through hearsay. And I've done a lot of investigation on this, and so I really do think that that is what happened, that some people were gossiping and couldn't keep the story in and told this reporter.
Interesting. Have you ever tracked this guy down or tracked down anyone, you know, from the paper of that era to find out more information about how it all came to be?
Stanton Friedman did. And the newspaper reporter did not want to cooperate with Stanton. And he told Stanton that all of the original reports that he had gotten, all of his original notes, had been left at the newspaper when he left the newspaper and had probably been destroyed. So Stan was not able to get any additional information.
That's interesting. Ironic that he doesn't want to cooperate, but he had no problem taking advantage of the story when it suited him. So, you know, that's his legacy, I guess, right?
Mm-hmm.
This has got you written all over it. The Mets stayed in a Pittsburgh hotel that also hosted a convention of people dressed up as furry creatures.
Oh, no.
Is this Wilbon's worst nightmare?
No, it's worse than my worst nightmare. My worst nightmare is mascots.
Look at that.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
What are they thinking, Bobby?
All right, let me tell you something. This is what here's the real story here. In 40 years worth of being on the road, traveling around this great land of ours, checking into countless hotels of all stripes, here's what I've learned. There's a frightening amount of subcultures out there, Mike, and they all have conventions.
Yeah, but you've never seen these people.
I want to understand one thing.
I've never seen them.
Stay away from me.
Thank you very much.